each one of us was taking the output of our receiver and coupling some of that audio into the transmitter. Not enough that the whole system went into oscillation, but we had a three-way, what would you call it now? Party conference? Conference line? Party line? In other words, we could all transmit, all talk and listen simultaneously, three guys. And we were almost in three different states. I'm on Long Island versus Albany. I'm going to call it another state, if you know what I mean. And Alan was over there in New Jersey. So three states, three guys, three frequencies, everybody hearing everything simultaneously. I'll admit that when Alan is listening to me, he's hearing me directly. When he's listening to Judd, he's hearing Judd indirectly being repeated by me. So each guy was listening to another guy directly and a third guy indirectly. So the audio volume was a little bit lower. You had to be careful to adjust the volumes so that the whole system didn't go into oscillation. So we were doing that with separate antennas. But there's nothing stopping you from doing that with a parabolic dish where you can feed a whole lot of frequencies into it simultaneously. A few guys have done 432, 1296, or 1296, 2304 megahertz simultaneously on the same dish, transmitting and receiving.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, it looks like we timed out to 375 again. Let me let it drop. Hasn't come back. Maybe I can make it come back. Let's see if I can do that. Nope, I don't seem to be able to do that right now. Last time we let it drop, 375 mysteriously came back at a later time. The dish itself doesn't give a darn about what frequencies you put into it and whether or not there's multiple frequencies simultaneously. Each individual frequency sees that metal reflector. That individual signal gets reflected. And by way of the dish and the horn's operation, no intermixing of the signal takes place. Not too different than, let me drop it. Happens in free space. Right now there's a whole lot of individual channels of television interference, television signaling and FM broadcast signaling all flowing through the air in your house simultaneously. Absolutely no mixing, no interaction takes place. And what's really amazing is that what happens in free space and what happens in coax cable is somewhat similar. You can have a signal going from the shack up to the antenna, and a signal flowing from the antenna back down to the shack simultaneously on the same piece of coax, and those signals do not intermix. They pass right through each other with no interaction. Even if the signal is on the exact same frequency, and even if the upgoing signal and the downgoing signal came from the exact same transmitter, that cable still treats them as independent events and does not mix them. Very similar to what happens on a slotted line. Let me drop. You could have a signal going on your slotted line from left to right, another signal going from right to left, and you move the probe of your detector on the slotted line along the length of the slotted line, and you'll see peaks and valleys. Those peaks and valleys of sums and differences of those signals were created inside of your probe because your probe is a non-directional antenna. It picks up the signal from left to right and the signal is traveling from right to left with equal alacrity, and then it mixes them together in that detector that's inside of your probe. And as you guys have heard me say so often, you could, in theory, take the slug out of a bird wattmeter, which is a directional detector, and use that as the probe on a slotted line. And even though you might have real measurable standing wave ratio on that slotted line as you move that bird slug along. And unfortunately, 375 is still up in the air. As you move that slug along, there would be no standing wave ratio. You aim the slug in the direction that measures the forward signal, and you slide the slug along the slotted line, and you'll see no variation in power. Rotate the slug 180 degrees. It's now measuring the signal in the other direction. Move it along the slotted line. There will be no variation. That's a pretty strong piece of evidence. Let me drop. That's a pretty strong piece of evidence that this flat-out kind of coaxial cable that's inside of the slotted line does not mix those signals together. They only appear to be both there in a plus and minus manner when you put that simple probe down into the slotted line, which has no directional characteristics. It does the intermingling, the mixing, the summing in differences. To really understand how a directional coupler works, you have to sort of accept that characteristic. If the air in your room mixed those signals together, if the coaxial cable mixed those signals together, life would get a lot more complicated. You'd have a lot more trouble running more than one broadcast station in a particular area simultaneously. They'd be interfering with each other, if you know what I mean. They don't. Anybody have any further questions or comments on all of the above? Give me a call, let us right now. K2RIW and TechNet.
WQB with a question on the dish.
You got it.
Okay. How about this? If we had a dish, you know, like a 20-foot dish, and we put the horns on the perimeter of the dish, and the signal is being fed to the focus point, and at that point, we have something like a prism, which will now send the signal down to the dish through a lens which will disperse that signal for the full width of the dish. Could something like that be made? We could put maybe 20 horns around the perimeter of the dish.
This is slightly similar to so-called beam waveguide. The 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California is using beam waveguide. In other words, it's the equivalent of a horn below the pivot point, below the ground on that dish, aiming a signal up to the subreflector on the dish. Subreflector signal gets dispersed with just the right beamwidth, so to speak. It hits the main dish and it goes out into space. The reason they did that is the air line, the beam waveguide air line, has essentially no loss. If you really ran a piece of waveguide or a coax cable from the basement of the building where the transmitter is up to the subreflector, you'd have some number of decibels of loss. The beam waveguide has essentially no loss. Now, so you could, if you want to, have these zillions of feed horns around the perimeter dish aiming the signal at the focal point. And at the focal point, you've got this fancy prism-like or whatever reflector. Let me drop. But why would you want to get the signal to the feed, to the focal point in that manner, as opposed to having a broadband piece of transmission line that brings the signal up to a horn that's at the focal point, and the horn is designed to be broadband? Now, you may say that you're trying to avoid the insertion loss of the transmission line going up to the horn. Nothing stopping you from feeding that horn in the beam waveguide manner, where you can make the loss become extremely small, lower than the loss you could ever get from any piece of waveguide or coax cable. Free space has no loss. It has dispersion. In other words, it obeys the inverse square law, because you double the distance between you and that transmitting horn. At that greater distance, the horn is sending the same amount of angular signal. The horn might be 2 degrees wide in azimuth and 2 degrees wide in elevation. You double the distance of the wall in front of the horn, so to speak, and you've quadrupled the amount of area that the dish is, that the horn is now covering. Let me drop. Because you've doubled the distance, which is quadrupled the area, that means each square meter is getting 1/4 of the amount of power, 60 dB down. Now you see the nature of the inverse square law. We call it free space laws. Free space has no laws. I could put an isotropic antenna in the middle of a spherical room. Because the spherical room has a diameter of, let me pick a number, 10 meters, so with every signal flowing from the horn to the walls of the spherical room has to flow through 5 meters of space. And I could calculate how many dB of loss I get over 5 meters. So if I set up receiving antennas in various places along the surface of the spherical room, I'm going to measure a predictable amount of signal. However, if I now add up all of the power received by all of the wall of this spherical room from that isotropic antenna, assuming the isotropic antenna in the center is transmitting 100 watts, and I add up all of the power received by all of that surface of that spherical room, it will be 100 watts. All the power from the isotropic antenna in the center all ended up on the walls of that spherical room. There was no loss. So if you know what you're dealing with in the mathematics, air has no loss. Free space has no loss. Gives you a little bit of a hint of why beam waveguide is so effective and why it's such a valuable thing to do. The first time you hear this, I know it doesn't make a lot of sense, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Dick, would 1 feed horn be able to handle 20 different information streams? That's possible.
Absolutely. Now, assuming your feed horn has one simple transmission line going into it, your big problem is how do you combine the 20 signals without insertion loss? If the 20 signals were on 20 different frequencies, although it would be difficult, there's nothing stopping you from making a 20-to-1 multiplexing filter. In other words, there's a common line to the filter that goes out to the 20 filters, and the 20 filters go to the 20 transmitters, and that thing will obey the law of reciprocity. It's a multiplexer. And now, in theory, you can make each one of those filters have nearly 0 decibels of insertion loss. So that's the frequency diversity method of combining the signals, 20 signals into that horn. You could do it very simply, passively, by combining them with hybrids. However, hybrids have a built-in termination. The termination there is in order to create isolation between the multiple inputs. But by definition, you pay a price for that isolation, insertion loss. A 2-to-1 hybrid power divider must have 3.01 dB of minimum insertion loss. Because of the way it does its combining, half the power is going into that termination. On reception, on transmission, no problem. It appears to be violating reciprocity. Well, when you're using it as a power splitter, the two signals coming out are thoroughly coherent. By the same token, when you're putting those two signals back in to use the power divider at
repeater, time out.
When you're using the power divider as a summer, oh, we're back on the air. On 375. When you're using that as a summer, if the two signals being summed are on different frequencies, you will experience 3 dB of insertion loss if the power is appearing into your termination. If you're smart enough to make the two signals that you're summing on the exact same frequency on the exact same phase, all of a sudden your 2-to-1 power divider acting as a summer has no insertion loss. You could say that the determination, in the case of a Wilkinson hybrid, determination only sees the instantaneous voltage difference between the two signals. If you're smart enough to make the two signals on the exact same frequency, the exact same amplitude, the exact same phase, then at every instant of time, the termination sees 0 volts and the insertion loss goes to 0. Mathematically, that's not easy to figure that one out when you're looking at the mathematics of a hybrid. Your directional coupler follows that characteristic, John. If you had a 10 dB directional coupler, let me drop. And I'm using it in the power dividing mode. I'm going to get a straight through signal that's got almost a dB of loss. And I'm going to get a second signal at the directional port that's 10 dB down. And if I take those two signals with that exact power ratio and feed them backwards, the directional coupler has no insertion loss. If I plugged in only the main signal going down the straight through line and forget the signal coming out of the 10 dB directional port, don't bother putting that signal in there, all of a sudden the directional coupler on the straight through line has a dB of loss. And where's the extra power going? To that internal termination. When you duplicate reciprocity, in other words, when you're feeding it in the forward direction where it's doing power dividing, 10 dB down on one port and essentially 1 dB down on the other port, and you measure those conditions, signal strength, amplitude, phase, and you reverse it, then you could say the internal termination is seeing a certain amount of signal from the straight through signal, it's seeing a certain amount of signal from the 10 dB coupled signal, minus 10 dB coupled signal, and at the termination, those two signals are 180 degrees out of phase, they cancel, and the termination sees nothing. Now, one of the articles that I've got in Mike's array of articles about directional couplers used for measuring standing wave ratio and power, let me drop. One of those articles goes through this example, and the first time you read that article, you'll say, gee, that doesn't seem to make sense. You have to dig a little bit deeper. It does make sense. And we're not violating the laws of conservation of energy here. Combining RF, could you combine 20 signals losslessly? Yes. I'll admit it's difficult. Maybe that answers the question, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Very good. Yes, it does. Question on the coupler. If you're using it straight through, you say there's a 1 dB loss, but that's only true if the sampling port was terminated, wouldn't it be?
Good guess. No. Very good guess, but no. And let me do the mathematics here. I know that a 10 dB coupler, out of the directional port, the signal is 10 dB down, 1/10 the power. Therefore, 9/10 of the power exists on the straight through port. And by definition, I've been calling it 1 dB of loss. It's a little bit less than 0.5 dB of loss. So, you will get 0.5 dB of loss on the straight through line, no matter which direction you feed the signal through the straight through line. However, if you're smart enough to feed in the reverse direction, so to speak, the straight through line signal and the second signal 10 dB down from your signal generator into the directional port with the right phase angle, all of a sudden the straight through line doesn't have any loss anymore. And no matter whether when you're feeding it in the forward direction where it's dividing the power straight through and 10 dB down, if you don't terminate the 10 dB down port, you'd like to believe that the insertion loss of the straight-through line changes. It does not. Those two output ports are thoroughly isolated from each other. So whether or not you do or don't terminate one, the other one doesn't know the difference. I know that sounds crazy at first. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
KC2WGB. I just got a note from Roy. He did a back-of-the-envelope calculation, and a 300 lumen light would generate approximately a nanonewton.
How about that? A 300 lumen flashlight, roughly a nanonewton. Good old Roy. We got to do something to give him an antenna so we can hear his signal on the air, John. And some of the articles that he's written to you, me, and Wes are very well composed. I know that by occupation, I believe he is a physician. But he appears to be one of those rare physicians that simultaneously has a very heavy physics background. Are you getting that impression, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. Yes, he does. And he's into a lot of things that I'm into. He knows a lot about philosophy and some of these people like Thucydides, and he's read a lot of the same books. So it's great getting his messages. Love it. And he's always listening and always has some really helpful comments. And, you know, some of the things that I know he believes are nonsense, he still spends time trying to explain it, so I think that's wonderful. So I give him a lot of kudos there.
I'll pick up Russ in a second. My mind's going blank. Tell me Roy's call letters. AC2, what is that again? Asked you. Okay. So that's beautiful. 300 lumens out of a flashlight has a kickback force on the flashlight of roughly a nanonewton, or you could also say simultaneously that the screen that the 300 lumens is hitting is also experiencing roughly a nanonewton of force. And whether or not that screen is black or a mirror might make the difference between 1 nanonewton or 2 nanonewtons of force on the screen. Yeah, I think if the screen was reflective black, you'd get a nanonewton. And if you make it into a mirror, the mirror would experience 2 nanonewtons because the light's going in, being stopped and reversing, and coming back out in the other direction. So as you can see, solar sails don't give you a hell of a lot of thrust. The price of the force is right, but the magnitude is kind of small and not always easy to use. I wonder if your calculation was close to that one, WS2N, K2LAW.
Well, I have a problem with Roy's calculation, and at first I have a problem because of inability to convert it right away. We have a 2 per second. Let me put it this way. If we try to convert 2 per second to Newton meter seconds, roughly we're going to have it the same, which will be 200. But then, hold on. If we go with lumens to watt calculator, that would be not a big deal for that. Then we have something like efficacy. I don't know if I pronounce it this way, but probably. But lumen per square meter is easy to convert it to foot candles, which we're not really including here, and calculation between the wavelength and frequency energy for me creates a problem, because if we, let's say, pick up for that photon energy a certain wavelength. Gonna have, let's say, let's put it 500 nanometers. And we try to think what is the energy in kilojoules or mole of photons of this radiation. Then we have to convert it first from nanometers to meters, then determine the frequency, then determine the energy, and then it is the important point is the energy of the photon. Then we determine the energy of mole of photons, and then we could actually think if we wish to direct the calculation somehow to neutrons, which then neutrons has to be per area. So let's say we have a lumen square centimeters, we have a 300, and let's say we go to the conversion watt square centimeter. Then we're going to have it at frequency, let's say 500 or 555 nanometers. It will come to 0.4 of watts per square centimeters. So now we have given area that is corresponding lumens to watts per square centimeters. But then we have a problem because lumens don't convert to newtons. So we gotta have a newton per meter, newtons per centimeter, so newtons per square inch, whatever it is. And then I got stuck in here. You gotta understand that whenever you calculate lumens, you must of have a distance, because then we have the intensity, and that intensity is that word that I wasn't able to say. Hold on. Efficacy, that word, which so if we don't have that far, so we cannot calculate it. That's why I have a problem with Roy's calculation. I appreciate
it. Yeah, I guess there's a slim possibility we've got a problem when I talked about 300 lumens. And I thought I was talking about 300 lumens being the equivalent of X number of watts, so to speak. And maybe lumen really is watts per square meter. It's a power flux density. I'm looking at my HP50G under the subject of light, and it will do conversion between foot candles, foot Lamberts, lux, VH, I'm not sure what that is, SB, I'm not sure what that is, lumens, candles, and Lamberts. Boy. We need some more units of light, lots of them. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, at first, another thing is we have a flashlight, and let's say the flashlight is 1 inch. So then 1 inch circle diameter, I was trying to convert to square centimeters, which equals 5.7 square centimeters. And then, based on that, do the calculation. But actually, I came to nowhere. Without giving information, I could not really do it, but...
The light, 2 centimeters. Don't use inches.
No, you don't understand, John. It's an area. We're not talking about 300 lumens of unknown, coming from unknown area. So whatever the unit you use, you don't know how big is the flashlight. You don't know how far is the screen. You cannot really do the efficient calculation in here. But say we take 500 nanometers, right? So 500 nanometers, convert nanometers to meters. It would be easier. So 500 nanometers is 500 times 10 to minus 9 meters equals 5,000 times 10 to minus 7 meters. Then we determine the frequency. So that would be gamma B equals C, and that would be 5,000 times 10 to minus 7 meters. Then it would be the if we look for the X, that would be 3.0 times 10 to minus 8 meters per second, which X would be then 6 times 10 to minus 14, 10 to 14 S minus 1. Okay, so if we try to determine energy, then the energy would be, that's what I said before, E equals HV. So then we'll come to somewhere 3.9756 times 10 to minus 19 joules, and that would be the energy for one photon. And then we have to have the information of the area and the distance from the screen, and it gets stuck with converting it to newtons. So I have a problem with Roy's explanation.
I don't think you need the energy of the screen involved. I don't think the screen has anything to do with it. If you know photon energy, then you determine the diameter of the flashlight. You know, calculate your photon. All it is whatever energy is in that photon is being applied to the flashlight. Opposite reactions.
You can, I was asked to convert lumens per square centimeter, lumens, just lumens. Now, I wasn't told is per square centimeters, per square inch, or whatsoever, what is the area. Then I was asked to convert them to newtons. Now, what is newton? Is it newton per area? What is it? So then I converted it to watts per square centimeters for me at given frequency, which would be then justify the energy of photon. And then if we're talking about energy of photon, we should go to the electromagnetic radiation spectrum, which will give you the, what is the frequency that is just to, it's interesting discussion, because how much of the energy has one photon at 555 nanometers, how much of the energy has the photon of X-ray or gamma ray. So we were specifying the region, but that region by itself has an enormous difference from the close to infrared visible light to the ultraviolet light and to X-ray.
I am guessing what Roy did is he made some logical conclusions. He chose a diameter for the flashlight and chose an approximate wavelength that the flashlight is operating at, because the eye sees it as white light. So the beam width, he can make a good guess on. The diameter of the flashlight, he can make a good guess on. The wavelength, he can make a good guess on. And all that came down to 300 lumens. According to my calculator, a lumen, the basic units, the universal base of a lumen, seems to be candle multiplied by stair radians. So there's an area relationship there, candle and stair radians. From that I can tell that if I had a light-emitting diode, the focal point of a parabolic mirror, that is my flashlight. And so therefore the total amount of joules of energy coming out of the light-emitting diode at the focal point, I'm not changing that. But if I suddenly yank away the parabolic reflector, although the same number of joules of energy is coming out of the light-emitting diode, I think the lumens will now change without the focal effect of the parabolic mirror. I'm not getting the same beam intensity. I'm guessing that lumens really is beam intensity. It's got an area and a energy relationship. Is that roughly it, Wes? I'm not as familiar with these terms as you can tell. N2XJN, K2RAW.
N2XJN. What I would say is we should start from the beginning before we go further. So the audience could understand a mechanism in it in order to be able to just picture it. The individual photon is invisible light, have energy of pure electron volt. And energy is then what actually was a concern in the question, what I understand, ladies up. But why particles in the cosmic rays with the equivalent frequency of around 10 to 25 hertz have relatively enormous energy of 10 billion electron volts. That would be 1.6 nanojoules. Now, you're asking me, okay, convert nanojoules to neutrons. I cannot do it. But anyhow, let me go further. So the nanojoule is very small. The total energy flow associated with the radiation is many, many times greater due to the very high number of photons making up the overall photon flux. So now, below the frequency of about 100 gigahertz, which includes the most of the spectrum used for the radio communication, the energy of individual photon is almost negligible at less than 10 to minus 4 electron volts to 10 to minus 24 joules. So it would be like a 10 to minus 4 electron volts equals somewhere 10 to minus 24 joules. So then we go to the photon flux of the radiated wave that would be defined as, say, number n. Let's put it number n of it. So that would be the n of photons per second per unit area of the wave that is given by phi equals n divided by m squared seconds. So then the energy E associated with the photon is given by E equals n times h times f joules. Anyhow, the number of photons n in E joules, or the energy of any frequency of the wavelength, then we could calculate. We could calculate the number of photons per joule. We could calculate by that radiation intensity depends on both the photon and the flux and the frequency of the radiation. However, we cannot convert it to neutrons. There is too little information given, and actually, I don't know how to do it. Convert lumens to neutrons. Not related.
The diameter of the flashlight makes no difference.
Correct. The diameter of the flashlight makes no difference, but in terms of the conversion, you gotta know efficiency, which is density, which would be the strength, actually. That would be the more proper word. Strength. In other words, you have your flashlight, you have your screen at a given distance, and you want to know how many watts per second do you have, or how many you want to know how much of the power is accumulated on that screen. There are so many variables over here. We can have a lumens per square meter, or say foot per candles, that is convertible into a gear.
Yeah, I'm guessing that Roy made some logical guesses as to beam widths, diameters, distances, and so on.
Probably did a rough average for frequency, Dick, right?
Oh, yes. The fact that it's optical, the lowest frequency and the highest frequency your eye will respond to is only an octave apart. So you've pinned down the frequency within a better than a 2-to-1 ratio when you're saying that the eye is responding to it. And being a typical flashlight, we know that the reflector is not a mile in diameter. We know it's not a millimeter in diameter. We can come up with some logical definitions for the area of the beam coming out of the flashlight, its dispersion, its wavelength. So with some logical conclusions,
it has nothing to do with it, Dick. The photons are from the bulb, so it's the bulb. It doesn't matter the size of the reflector.
I don't know. Hold on, babe. John, you don't understand. You try to, let's say, convert luminous flux in lumens, right? And you try to convert it to watts. And then you have a problem. Where do you have a problem? Over there. So you need to have efficiency. If you could tell me how to properly... So
If there is no predefined luminous efficacy value given, you cannot calculate it. And I wasn't asked that, I wasn't told that until it's here.
Yeah, if you remove the reflector, John, now the light bulb might be an isotropic radiator. And if it radiated the same amount of light in all directions at once,
the reflector only directs it in one direction. It doesn't matter the size, whether it's 5 inches or whether it's 1 inch. Same amount of photons.
No, it is not.
If I was shooting bullets, John, out of a gun, and I shot them all to the north, I know the gun is going to kick to the south. If I've got a whole array of guns that are shooting north, south, east, west, up and down simultaneously, I can be getting a lot of energy coming out of those bullets, out of those guns, but the net force of that array of guns would go to zero, to kick back.
Dick, that's not what I was saying. You need the reflector to direct them, but it has nothing to do with changing how many photons are coming out of the bulb. We're going to send them all to the north, but it doesn't matter if you do it with a 10-inch reflector or a 1-inch reflector. They're all going to go to the north.
All right, could you tell me what is the lumens per watt area? Lumens per watt. That means you have a flux, okay? The flux is 300 lumens. Okay, now you want to convert it to, let's say, watts. Now you need to know how many lumens is per watt. And that is not given.
I wasn't talking about that. I was telling Dick something else, and he was responding to something else, not that question. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, the funny thing that goes on here, John, is that as I do or don't put in the reflector for the exact same bulb, the number of lumens that you come out with changes. As you use a bigger reflector and the beam is more concentrated, the lumens, which is really the kind of watts per square meter, goes up. Even though the total watt...
No, you're talking about lux. You're right with lux, not with lumens. Lumens are defined by the bulb.
No, we were not asked for lux, we were asked for lumens, John.
The units of lumen is candle times stair radians. Stair radian is beam width. So beam width times candles is lumen. So there is an area relationship. There is an angular relationship there, as I see it, John.
Okay, but as long as they're all going in the same direction, and it doesn't matter how broadband you spread them out, all of the photons are going to the north. So that means they're leaving the flashlight, and you have action, reaction. The action to the flashlight is going to be perfect. It's going to have direction.
All right, let me try this one on you. I've got two antennas on 432, one with a narrow beam width and one with a broad beam width. I put the same number of watts into both antennas, and 100 feet away I measure a signal strength. I will measure a different signal strength, a higher signal strength, on the higher gain antenna. Both antennas are sending the signal to the north. One's doing it with a narrower beam width, therefore, I will measure more watts on that feed horn that's receiving the signal from the higher gain antenna. Yes, the total amount of kickback is almost the same because it's the same number of watts going north. But the number of watts that I the signal strength that I measure at the remote site, which is the equivalent of lumens, I think it's going to be different. Over to you, John.
Well, if they're spread over a wider area and you're not receiving all of them, yes. But that's not what we're dealing with. We're just dispersing them in a direction. We don't care what's happening to them after they leave.
Okay. If I change the size of the reflector, but don't change the bulb in any way, and I'm 10 feet away, I measure lumens. I get a big reflector and a small reflector. Do I get the same number of lumens on those two measurements?
No, because you're going to be measuring them on an area calculation, so many lumens
per square centimeter, or so much lux per square, say, millimeter, if you want. Yeah, that's going to change as you widen it out, but that has nothing to do with the energy that is coming out of the flashlight causing it to move forward. That's only, you're measuring it over a broader distance, so sure, it would be a lot less, and the further you go back, it'll be even more.
I think I agree with it.
At first, I think John don't understand. Lumen is per square area, square meter, or say foot candles. Now, what is lux, John?
Lux is reference to area. Lumens are reference to the bulb energy.
John, Eric, here we go. Wes, you said area. You mean angular area in star radians. I'll get a different number of square meters of light if I'm at a long distance or a short distance. So lumens has the unit of steradian. It's an angular measurement in there, as well as the candles. Go ahead, Wes.
That's correct. But lux is illuminance or luminous emittance, which is measuring the luminous flux per unit area. And that's what, so it is equal to one, it is equal to one lumen per square meter. But those are two different animals.
No question in that. Maybe we should just have an astronaut take a flashlight up to space.
It looks like I probably didn't hear the original question of the 12 years old. Could you repeat it?
By the way, the unit of lux is candle times steradian divided by square meters. That lux unit is a tough one.
We're talking about lux. It is a luminous emittance, or say, measuring the luminous flux per unit area. It would be equal to one lumen per square meter. I'm reading right now. In photometry, this is used as the measure of the intensity as perceived by the human eye of light that hits or passes through the surface. Through the surface. So it is analogous to the radiometric unit watts per square meter. But with the power at each wavelength weighted accordingly to the luminosity function, I had a problem to convert lux to newtons. There were no additional information given, and to HGM.
You're right, you can't do it exact. But you can make some approximations as to angular characteristics of the flashlight, area of the flashlight, wavelength of the signal coming out of it. You can make some approximations and come up with a ballpark figure. That's what I think Roy did.
Possibly it is. Yeah. John, could you repeat what was the original question of the 12 years old?
Well, like Roy said, lux is not lumens. All right. It was very simple, Wes, and you overcomplicated it tremendously. The child asked, the young man asked, if a flashlight was brought into space, not near the Earth, into empty space, quasi-empty space, and turned on, would it move? That was his simple question. And I believe, like Dick, yes, it will move. Imperceptibly, we might be able to measure it. I believe it's possible to measure it, but only over a long time. That was his question, Wes.
And by the way, the lowest amount of light energy I can think of is an extremely long wavelength with very little joules per cycle, so to speak. I'm talking about the thermal heat coming off the transmitter on the Voyager space probe. And all that heat coming off of that transmitter is on the backside of the parabolic dish that's aimed at Earth. That thermal energy over those 35 years, continuously coming off that thing,
created an extremely small amount of flux. NASA measured the error in the trajectory of Voyager due to the thermal energy that's boiling off of that transmitter, reflected off the back of the dish. There's a beautiful article where they had to collect a whole lot of the old tapes that were stored under a staircase somewhere in NASA in order to put this all together. They knew they were getting a continuous error. And some guy with a real scientific bent decided to investigate it. And he knew how many watts the transmitter is dissipating. He knew how big the dish is that the signal is reflecting off of. So he had good approximations on everything. When he plugged it all in, it came out extremely close to the trajectory error that they did measure. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. And I'm sure as the power went down, the error went down. That would be another thing that he could confirm. But, that's interesting. So if that's it, I guess that's QED. So the kid has to know that the light, over a long period of time, will move.
I have one of the answers.
Yeah, the answer has got to be yes. Very similar to putting a cup of water into the Long Island Sound. Did the tide raise? Absolutely. It has no choice. Can you measure it? Wow. Is that tough? Go ahead, Wes.
We're talking about the vectoral physics, and let's say we have a flashlight in the space, and then we have photons moving out. Okay. Now, one of the possible answers that I see, and I found that on the internet, so it wasn't really by 12 years old, is you cannot add the speed of light. If you rode the bicycle with the flashlight on it at nearly the speed of light, the light leaving the flashlight would still only be moving the speed of light. I'm not really picturing. Are you talking about the reverse vector, like you have the ion engine in the space, and then by ions going one way, the spacecraft is moving the other way?
Yeah, let me repeat it as I heard it, Wes. The very simple question asked was, when you turn on that flashlight in free space, will it move? What's your guess on that one, Wes?
Well, photon is energy. Energy is comparable to the mass. And when you have a photon being ejected, which is the free energy, another the free energy, which is the energy, right? But it's not yet in mass. It should not move, because we don't have a mass, unless we convert it to mass and to HGN.
So let me run that by again. Even though Roy, who we think, John and I think Roy is quite traceable to the Bureau of Standards, if you know what I mean. We use him as a reference oscillator. He's fairly sure that when you turn on the flashlight, it will move. And he gave us a rough approximation number. A nano-newton. You're saying when you turn on the flashlight or don't turn on the flashlight, in both cases, the flashlight in free space will not move. Is that what you're saying, Wes?
Yes, well, at first we're not dealing with mass. But in put in motion, stay in motion. The ion engine in the space works this way, that ions is the mass. So when you move mass, the other mass must move in the opposite vector. Now we're dealing with the energy. We're not dealing with mass. And electromagnetic wave, which photon is a unit of electromagnetic wave, does not have a mass. And to HGN.
Well, then why is the spacecraft drifting off course when it's transmitting? That doesn't sound right.
Do
Do photons, although the mass is extremely small, do photons have any mass?
Based on official physics, photon does not have a mass. It's a unit of energy.
But there was a real empirical measurement. The Voyager space probe is radiating heat off the back of that dish, and that is changing the trajectory. They've measured the error in the trajectory. They've measured the amount of heat coming out. They went through the calculation, and it seemed to correlate. Over to US, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm having right now something of interest. Photon. Elementary particle, quantum of light, and other forms of electromagnetic radiation, and a fourth carrier for the electromagnetic force. Even when static, via virtual photons, the effects of the force are easily observable at both microscopic and macroscopic level. Because the photon has a zero rest mass, this allows long distance interaction.
If a photon has no mass, Wes, how does a solar sail give you any thrust?
Are you talking about the ion engine, or I'm trying to understand what you're talking about?
It has an inertial mass equivalent. It has no rest mass.
But it's not at rest. NASA, on a couple of experiments, has put a large area in space called a sail, a little bit like a sailboat, and let the sunlight shine on that sail, and it does give them a measurable amount of thrust. So the photons from the sun hitting the sail seem to give thrust. The only slight question I've got is, was the solar wind particles, real particles, also hitting the sail? And were those, with the amount of thrust from the solar wind, contaminating the experiment? Does the solar sail still get thrust from photon energy coming from the sun? WS?
Yeah, I just noticed that you might be right, guys, and I might be wrong. Like all elementary particles, photons are currently being explained by quantum mechanics and exhibit wave-particle duality. It's like the properties of both waves and particles. So if we were to take a particle's properties, then you are right. So for example, the single photon may be refracted by the lens or exhibit wave interference by wave itself, but also acts as a particle giving a defined result when its position is measured. And to achieve.
Yeah, we're about to be cut off. This was TechNet number 1520 of the series. And when it comes to these photons, luxes, and microcandles, candelas, and all these other units, we're going to get a little closer to the truth next week. What do you think, John? KC2WGB, K2AIW.
One count candle power is pretty good. You can see a candle 10 miles in good darkness. So I want to thank Ray for his patience. And all of his comments, it was greatly appreciated, Roy. So see you all next week. And thanks for participating in the net. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Bye-bye, you guys. See you down the log.
Thank you very much, Dick. Thank you very much, Roy. Thank you very much, John.
Very good, sir. Yeah, good topic.
John, you got me good.
What is that supposed to mean?
I don't know the answer, John.
Okay, I'll meet you at 147. KC2WGB, QSY.